Welcome back to the Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt, director of Taiyu Meditation Center and co-founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Mini Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol. This week, our guest by telephone is Dean Radin. Dean Radin, Ph.D., is chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and co-editor-in-chief of Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. His latest book is Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities, published this year by Deepak Chopra Books. So, before the break, we started to touch on some of the headier questions of this work, which is, why does all this stuff happen? It sort of runs against our more conventional scientific folklore about materialism and separation of objects and consciousness being an epiphenomenon of the brain. And I'm interested, from your perspective, if there's been progress since some of your earlier work in explanations or theoretical understandings that might form the beginnings of a more comprehensive explanation at the level of formal language for this kind of work.
Well, I think there is progress. I don't actually know whether it's only because I've been paying attention to it, or whether it's always been there. I just wasn't thinking about it. But it's about this issue of we think of a knowledge pyramid, more or less, where the bottom of the pyramid is physics, and then on top of that is chemistry, and on top of that is biology and psychology at the top. And somewhere at the very tip-top is an emergent property that we call consciousness. That's more or less the materialistic view. And it's been very successful. And the idea of reductionism, which is built into this knowledge pyramid, is also very successful. In which case, why do we need to change anything? Well, a lot of scientists think we don't. And the only place where it starts to break down is and you try to account for what actually is consciousness. So one of the prevailing views today is you take an artificial intelligence perspective and imagine that the brain is either a classical or maybe a quantum computer, and if it's sufficiently complicated, that the recursive circuits in the brain will give rise to awareness. And we can't say for sure that that's not true at this point, except that because there's pretty good evidence that psychic phenomena exist, that there's some peculiar aspect of consciousness that seems to transcend space-time. And that's a problem for materialism because it means that there, what we normally think of as a property that arises at the very tip-top of this knowledge pyramid somehow is prior to the bottom of the pyramid, which is physics and space-time. So how does that happen? Well, one possibility is that what looks like mind and what looks like matter are two sides of the same coin, or better yet, two sides of them will be a strip. And if you look carefully enough at one side of the strip and you keep following the logic around, you end up on the complete other side. And so mind and matter are really not that different. Along with that kind of an explanation is another possibility, which is that the bottom of our knowledge pyramid is not complete yet. In fact, the whole knowledge pyramid is just an artificial construct anyway, but if we just think in terms of slicing up the physical world, because we can't think of everything all at once, then maybe the bottom of our pyramid should be something more like consciousness or awareness. And this, of course, is like the major difference between Western and Eastern philosophy. Even though within Western philosophy we have idealism and within Eastern philosophy there are materialistic philosophies as well, in general, the Western world has embraced the idea of physicality at the bottom and the Eastern world has embraced the idea of consciousness at the bottom. So we can say, okay, maybe the Eastern philosophies are a little bit closer to what's actually going on because otherwise our evidence for psychic phenomena is extremely difficult to understand. The moment that you do allow this knowledge pyramid to include some fundamental with consciousness at the bottom, then it all makes perfect sense. So I'm guessing, I'm make a conjecture that something in the direction of an Eastern philosophical point of view, which from the West we might look at more or less as panpsychism, maybe that actually is pointing in the right direction. So if you look in philosophy and you look at what some physicists are looking at, some mathematicians over the past maybe 20 years, that I think you find more and more scholars and scientists who are beginning to dabble with the idea that maybe consciousness is far more fundamental than we had previously believed in the West. And then the issue is, well, how do you get from consciousness, assuming it's fundamental, how do you get from that, which is prior to space-time, into the universe at large, into a world where space and time are here? And that's where you find some interesting new developments. You find people taking artificial intelligence and virtual world approach and people doing information physics, all of which is trying to build up out of extremely fundamental and elementary ideas. You build it up into the development of space-time, and in some cases you find that it reproduces quantum mechanics. In other cases, you find that it's not inconsistent with what we know about relativity. So that's a direction where I expect in my next book I will probably dive headlong into this whole idea of a development of a new kind of scientific worldview where consciousness actually can be as seen as the fundamental, and the rest of the physical world arises from it.
So as I understand what you're saying, one question I have is, at the level that you were describing, is there a distinction between panpsychism and what I think Don Hoffman calls conscious realism? And the way I understand that is panpsychism suggests that there's at least coexistent, you know, consciousness or awareness or feeling or however you want to describe it, with matter, and that you can't really reduce one to the other. Whereas conscious realism takes a stronger position. I think it's more like the idealism that you mentioned, where almost that the material realm is an epiphenomenon of the interplay of consciousness.
Right.
Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, I believe that's correct. So consciousness and awareness as another property of existence, as like panpsychism would say, is very close actually to Sankhya philosophy, which is yoga philosophy. It says that simply the universe consists of consciousness. That's a property of the fabric of reality. And another part of the fabric of reality is the physical world as we know it. And so mind is somewhere in between. Whereas a more radical approach is the one that Don Hoffman and idealist philosophers propose, in which it really all does emerge out of some kind of a conscious primordial substance of some type.
A primordial observation matrix or something like that.
Yeah, not substance is not quite the right word, but yeah, something like a virtual matrix of some type.
So do I understand that intentionality is the arena of intersection that you've been exploring in general? I mean, certainly a lot of your work does that. Is that the key to getting a hold on consciousness, as it were?
I would say that actually, at least in terms of this discussion, that it's more about awareness,
okay,
and a little bit less so about intention.
Okay. How so?
Well, before you have intention, you have to have attention.
Okay.
And before you have attention, you have to have something that's aware of something. So you kind of work down to find what's more fundamental than the next thing. Well, it seems like at the very bottom, you need some form of awareness or sentience or something like that. And then you add on to it attention, which focuses it, and then intention, where you kind of push the focus and so on. So I would think at bottom, awareness is probably a better word to use than consciousness, because consciousness is almost too big. It includes everything. So awareness seems to be the part that is extremely difficult to account for.
Right. That all makes sense. But I guess what I was asking and wasn't clear about was, it seems to me that the experiments that at least I'm familiar with that you've been doing seem to have a lot to do with intention as a key into understanding how some of these, how awareness would govern this phenomenon. Am I misunderstanding your work?
Well, it's only some recent.
Uh-oh. I think we may have lost our guest again.
He might come back.
We'll hope that he'll come back again. In the meantime, I'll just mention that this is the Mystical Positivist, and we are hoping to get our guest,
okay,
Dean Radin.
Yeah, I'll hang up and then let him call back.
Okay.
But while he's calling back, just to answer your question, Rob, there's a number of other experiments that he's worked on that deal with things like psychokinesis and precognition and the like.
Hi. Let's get back. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
We're back. Yeah.
It seems that Skype is not behaving.
That's okay. Like I said, we're getting into some good stuff here, so that's a positive sign.
Right. So Stuart was answering as if he were you, explaining to me that that in fact some of your work on psychokinesis would have little or nothing to do, as I understand it, with intention studies, and that the intention studies are later. Is that an accurate representation?
Not just later, but just a class of studies that we're looking at.
Right.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
A big part of what I've done over the years is looking at psychophysiological responses to various kinds of stimuli, and those don't involve any conscious awareness at all. I mean, there's some level of awareness, but not usually conscious awareness.
And actually, I want to, by way of talking about theoretical foundations, I want to loop back around some of just those studies, because you introduced this concept or terminology for an effect called presentiment, which is the apparent anticipation of the nervous system in a subject, as you said, below their level of consciousness, to a stimulation that will randomly occur in the future. And if you could maybe outline just briefly presentiment for our listeners, then I have a more specific question about foundations.
Okay. So presentiment comes about from experiences that people report where they get a visceral sensation or a gut feeling about something that's unexpected and later turns out to be true. And so in the laboratory, what we do is we set somebody down and present a series of unpredictable stimuli, which could be calm pictures and emotional pictures randomly intermixed, or something as simple as a light flash that happens at an unpredictable time. Now we look at physiological indicators, such as skin conductance or heart rate, things like that, or brain waves, and see whether the physiology will differentiate depending on what the future target is under conditions not only where it's unpredictable, but where nobody knows in advance what's about to happen, because we use a true random number generator in order to determine what the future is going to be. So these studies, there are roughly 40 studies of this type looking at different physiological measures over the years. And a meta-analysis published last year shows that this is a repeatable effect in about 30 laboratories. And so somehow the body or the unconscious level of the mind is able to sense what is about to occur, even under conditions where you can't infer it and there's no sensory cues. So in this case, this does not appear to have anything to do with conscious attention or conscious awareness, because the body knows before you do. And because of this, there's the possibility that what's happening here is a reflection of simply the fabric of reality. And it's not something specifically mental, unless we think of part of our mental apparatus is not, we're not aware of it, but rather more about the way that time and events unfold that we're usually not aware of.
And you describe in the book that some of these studies have been replicated with animals, where you where you can actually see, I think you describe a finch, a particular finch, having an anticipatory response to the random showing of a picture of a snake or a gunshot, and that that to be very clear for our listeners, the effect in the bird, just like with the human, only comes up when, in fact, the random event, which is determined by a random number generator, is the emotionally charged event.
Right.
And so the foundation's question I had related to this is that within the last number of years, I've read some materials. There's a great a general article in Discover magazine, and there's some more technical papers about the work of Aharonov and Tullochson on time-symmetric quantum mechanics. And I'm sure you must be familiar with some of that material, right?
Yes, I am.
So what I got from that, particularly the more the general explanation in Discover magazine kind of laid it out, but the technical papers also described this, that they've essentially demonstrated a kind of a retrocausal measurement effect in quantum systems that don't involve people or animals or anything like that, and it wasn't really couched in terms of psi, but it was good old-fashioned quantum mechanics simply interpreted through a formalism or a formulation of it in a time-symmetric mode.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the delayed choice experiment in quantum mechanics, which is one of the fundamental experiments, that seems to imply some form of retrocausation. I mean, that's one way to interpret it.
Yeah. And as I understood, like, the time-symmetric quantum mechanics, their essential premise is that the state of a current system is not only the effect of states in the past, but also states in the future.
That's exactly right.
And that there's essentially a propagation of influence back in time, which they were able to measure. In other words, they were able to measure a state of a system that would be statistically different depending on how the final state was prepared.
Right. And so that's the idea of weak measurement in quantum mechanics, where you create your boundary conditions, or you define the boundary conditions, one of which is in the future, and then through weak statistical measurements, you're able to decipher what actually happened in the evolution of a system. And that does seem to point towards future boundary conditions influencing the present, just as the past seems to influence the present.
And I guess the question I have is, when I've saw that material, my first impression was that that was like an exact formalism for describing the retrocausal experiments that you've been involved in. Is that your impression as well?
Well, yes. It's from a quantum perspective, it's exactly the same. In fact, one of the theories about what's going on in presentiment is by a colleague who basically talks about it in terms of time symmetry. And what we see experimentally is that depending on the response time for a presentiment response, you can predict when the presentiment will occur. So by that I mean skin conductance takes roughly 3 seconds in order to appear and disappear, and that's in response to a stimulus. If you look 3 seconds before the stimulus, that's pretty much where you tend to see a presentiment in skin conductance. If you do it in heart rate takes roughly 9 seconds for the response to occur, and it's roughly 9 seconds before that you see a presentiment in heart rate. And the brain is about 1 second on either side of the stimulus. And other physiological systems, of course, have different lengths of response time. And that's almost as though it's like an echo or a mirror of the future response. That's where the presentiment response occurs.
So on the sense we're dealing with a potential explanation couched in quantum mechanics, the other interesting question is that to me is, you know, sometimes when I've had discussions with more materialistic friends of mine about such matters, they throw back, well, if you can, you know, if you have this effect, you could hook it up to you could figure out number to play on a roulette wheel or something like that pretty consistently. So the question is, when you show a presentiment effect, like you see, you know, that you see a statistical difference when you look at large numbers of data between something that happens before a particular random event takes place, when that random event is charged. If you could design a detector that was sensitive enough to recognize that before, could you actually predict? Could you have a computer make a separate prediction of what image would show up? Or would, by taking that measurement, would you be breaking a certain fundamental sort of superposition across time that would ultimately kind of destroy the coupled states or the entangled states that are actually giving rise to the phenomenon?
I suspect, and my colleagues who are doing the same research suspect, that you could develop a system which would give you a glimpse of what the future is about to be. It's not too useful for things like roulette, perhaps, or a game of chance, because you would only get an alert as a matter of seconds in advance. But in principle, you could use it for example, for avoiding a bomb or avoiding going into an intersection when the light has turned.
Right.
Something could tell you that, you know, within 5 seconds you're going to have a very emotional thing happen.
Or like micro trading now with systems in the financial world. I mean, there are very...
Right, but of course those are computers that are running at rates much faster than humans. But in principle, yes, you could have a presentiment of what's about to occur. The difficulty has been that the effect so far is weak enough so that you only can see it with lots of repeated trials. But I think in principle that might be able to overcome at some point. I mean, the analogy here is that when you do studies involving the brain and evoked responses in the brain, it can take hundreds and hundreds of repeated trials before you begin to see the signal through the noise. And that's considered completely normal in EEG research, because the brain is a very noisy system. So this is no different than that. But what is beginning to happen within EEG research is so-called synthetic telepathy, where there's enough computing power that can be brought to bear to individual signals to figure out what the likely result is, even in a single trial.
Hmm.
So if we get to the point, and there is a colleague of mine in Italy who is doing this now with pupil dilation, trying to see on a trial-by-trial basis, can you outguess what's about to happen? He claims that there, you can, to some statistical degree. If we get to the point where you're able to use this for trial-by-trial indication of the future, a much more interesting thing to do for me, rather than going into a casino, although that might be interesting too. What's more interesting is to do what you were alluding to, which is what's called bilking the future. You create an experimental context where you set up that there's going to be an emotional response in the future. You set it up probabilistically, like 90% chance that you're going to have an emotional response in your future. Now, we can't know exactly because then it would be determined. But if there's a 90% chance, you get the person's physiological response, and then you make a decision. Sure enough, it's emotional, and then you switch it so that what they see is calm, and vice versa. And so the bilking is you've changed the future. And then you introduce a causal paradox. And then the question is, well, now what? If you switch the future, will you be able to turn off presentiment? Because now there's nothing to respond to? Will you unravel the thread that holds together the universe? We don't actually know.
That can be same question that Oppenheimer had when they exploded the first atomic bomb.
A little bit. It's like the story of the Navajo rug. You know, if you pull the right thread on the Navajo rug, the whole rug will fall apart. And so a friend of mine is a physicist who tells me every so often in an email, I can tell that you haven't done that experiment yet because we're all still here. And so far, he's right. We don't have a signal that's strong enough in order to clearly test if it's possible to create a causal paradox.
That is an interesting experiment. I have to let that one sink in.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the other areas that I guess there's been some work in is formulations of quantum mechanics that deal with macro systems that essentially try to describe macro quantum mechanical states. Do you think that any of those kinds of models have play in describing phenomena?
I think it does, but in the sense of what's called quantum cognition now, where this is not only considering the brain as a quantum object. Of course, the brain is a quantum object. The question is whether it behaves that way or not, and there's a lot of debate as to whether that's the case. But quantum cognition is a branch of mathematical psychology, which is using quantum formalisms to describe ways that the brain, not just the brain, but that in cognition that are difficult to explain in conventional ways. And so one example of this is the so-called Guppy effect. And this is that if you ask somebody to name a pet, and then the likelihood that they're going to say Guppy is pretty small. If you previously talk about fish and fish tanks, and then you say, give me a pet, then the likelihood of Guppy is a lot more. But when you work on the joint probability of talking about a fish tank and then talking about pets and then talking about fish, the joint probability of ending up with Guppy is pretty small. And yet, actually, it's quite high. So empirically, it's high, but from conventional probabilistic sense, it's small. So this doesn't make sense from a classical perspective of what's going on in terms of probabilities, but it makes a lot more sense in terms of quantum formalisms, where the sequence in which you ask things or a sequence in which you do mathematics makes a much bigger difference, so-called commutative versus non-commutative mathematics. And so this is just one example of many now where ideas out of that are similar to what we see in quantum mechanics are being applied to cognition as it's measured and as cognition manifests to see whether there may be something about the idea of the mathematics and quantum mechanics that can be applied to other realms. And so in that sense, that's where I see the connection that might be useful for understanding psi events. Because, for example, if entanglement today is usually thought of as entanglement only between elementary particles and doesn't last for very long at all. If you have macroscopic quantum mechanics that actually do show entanglement among large-scale systems at room temperature or not, but at large-scale systems that can be described as a kind of entanglement, macro entanglement. And a lot of the psychic event makes sense. In fact, I'm now of macroscopic of understanding what's happening matter interaction in experiments.
We missed the
I'm afraid
the last our, phrase there.
Yeah, the signal got unsteady there.
Was it unsteady at the point where it was becoming very exciting?
It was for me.
Oh, well.
Did you pull a thread somewhere?
I may have pulled a conceptual thread, and that may be just as dangerous.
Yes.
All right.
So one other area that we've kind of talked around this a little bit, and with the presentiment experiments, there's this effect of apparently anticipatory behavior. I'm kind of interested in your read on the conventional argument that comes up from materialists these days on why it's kind of proven now that we don't have free will. And it's based off of sensitive measurements that show that, milliseconds, 500 milliseconds prior to me moving my arm or thinking about moving my arm, before I have the conscious experience of the intention of moving my arm, that you can see a registered behavior in the brain, I think, is where most of these studies look at. And when... That's usually trumpeted now as like, consciousness is a fabrication, or self intention is a fabrication of the mind, post hoc.
A story post hoc, yeah.
Post hoc, the actual underlying physiological behavior that's determining this. And yet I see your research and your results as kind of throwing a wrench in that interpretation.
Well, it's actually they're talking about different things. And in the case of studies like Benjamin Libet had done, which show this physiological anticipatory response before you're aware of it, those are all about making decisions and doing something. You have to do something. But a presentiment experiment is all about your response to an unpredictable future. You're not making a decision at all. And so, first of all, so that's a distinction that has to be made, because these experiments are not equal. And a presentiment experiment actually is compatible with the idea that most of what we think of as our decisions really are unconscious.
How so? You mean in the sense that the anticipatory response that arises is... hardwired, as opposed to something we're deciding to do.
That a presentiment response is not a decision. So that might simply be a reflection of time symmetry.
Okay.
And experience. Whereas an anticipatory response in prior to our conscious awareness of a decision might, in fact, show that there's some aspect of behavior in us that is kind of determined. It's determined by, in fact, we like all of social psychology is focused on this idea that a lot of our decisions, a lot of our behavior, is driven by things that we're not aware of.
Right.
And of course, that's a lot of what advertising is about. It's a lot about the act of persuasion in general. It's about being influenced by things that we're not consciously aware of. So our conscious awareness is a pretty thin slice of our cognition. And so it's not entirely clear to me that this means that we're all completely determined. We're not necessarily zombies, because if we are, we're zombies with a peculiar capacity to be aware and to override our decisions at the last second. But a lot of it is unconscious. And, I mean, you see this every day when you're driving on the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Most people are driving and they're not paying attention to what they're doing at all. And if they're not paying any attention, that's when you have accidents. But I would say most people, most of the time, have a little bit of attention on driving, but a lot of it is not there.
Right. So, and this is certainly consistent with our own background and our particular lineage of spiritual practice, that most people in an ordinary state aren't conscious of what, you know, that the things that manifest are have all these antecedent conditions that we're simply not aware of. And in fact,
Right. Meditation
is intended to bring illumination to those factors such that you can move them into a level, a realm of choice, rather than simply being the effect of them.
Exactly.
But it sounds like you agree that with sufficient attention on the these lower level effects, that choice is actually still something that's available.
Yes, and even in the Libet type of experiment, I think it's been shown that if you wish to override your what apparently predetermined anticipatory response, you can do it. So your conscious awareness does have priority over what is otherwise unconscious. So, yes, as you said, one of the reasons for becoming mindful is that you simply have a lot more capacity to choose. Otherwise, you will be kind of a zombie.
Got it. Well, as we're drawing to the close of our discussion, I was struck by one of the pictures in the book Supernormal. Let's see if I'm flipping through it right now, but I can describe it. Ah, here it is. It's on page 297 in the chapter called Future Human. And there you have this wonderful picture of a Hamiltonian operator acting on a quantum state being equated to, I think it's the second sutra of Patanjali's.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of begs the question of, so do you think with all of the work on foundations that has been done, is being done now, and that you're looking forward to jumping into, that we'll get to a point of having like a Schrodinger's equation, a fundamental equation that can describe something about the interaction of this stuff awareness and the material realm that can ultimately lead to consistent testing and prediction?
Yes. And the idea of that drawing or the illustration was that ultimately, whether it's external focus of science or internal focus of meditation or other spiritual practice, that we're all trying to gain a better sense of what is real and who we are. And if those two approaches continually diverge, then that's not something is not working right. But I think over time we are beginning to see a convergence. We're still not, you know, we're not together yet, but there is some kind of a convergence over time that I think I see arising, and of course I'm not the only one who sees it. So yeah, at some point in the future, I would like to see that we can elaborate on what the ancient wisdom tells us and what subjective awareness tells us, elaborate it to the extent so that it begins to merge into science. And that's why at the very end of the book, I'm basically saying that when that happens, and I'm pretty sure it will at some point, provided we're all still here, that's childhood's end. That's where we stop living in a kind of an illusion, where as we see now, the effect of this illusion is very dramatic in the world.
Yeah.
If we live in a world where everything is separate and things don't interact very much, then we will destroy ourselves. So I'm hoping that the ancient wisdom and modern knowledge converge, and I think good reasons to believe that's the direction that we're heading.
And are you seeing maybe a softening in the scientific community, the larger scientific community, towards these sorts of things? Like one difference, for instance, in this book from your previous books is I think there's been a couple of key papers that were actually published in quote-unquote reputable journals, even though it created a firestorm. But It seems like things are slowly changing. Is that your experience?
Well, yeah, I would say yes and no. Yes, in the sense that it is becoming, I think, easier to publish in mainstream journals. I have two articles now in Physics Essays, which is not a top-tier physics journal, but it is a mainstream journal. It's not known for sci research. We have colleagues have papers in Frontiers, which is now part of the Nature Publishing Group. And, of course, Daryl Bem published in Personality and Social Psychology, which is one of their top journals. So some of the past prejudices are beginning to break down. And it is almost always the case that younger scientists are much more interested in this stuff than older scientists because they don't have the same prejudices. So I'm optimistic, but I'm chronically optimistic. I mean, you have to be optimistic in order to do this kind of research because otherwise you face an enormous amount of prejudice that's still out there. And skeptics are not, I'm not talking about real skeptics, but the pseudo-skeptics are very vocal about why they think all of this is nonsense. And so it takes a certain degree of optimism and persistence to keep pushing against that. And I have great sympathy for my more conservative colleagues who simply decided that they don't want to have to deal with that. I mean, pushing against the prevailing ideas always creates a certain amount of pushback. But I've been involved in this now for almost 30 years, and I see a very different mainstream science landscape today than I saw when I first started this.
Well, that sounds pretty optimistic to me.
And yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, it seems to me that your work has the intention behind it to move things in that direction. That this is not just happenstance. That you've been working on this project for a long time. If project is the right word for it, is that mm-hmm. fair?
Yes, but it's also a large part of what I'm interested in is promoting tolerance within science. It sounds crazy awesome. To have to even talk about it
yeah,
in those terms.
Well, I think it's pretty awesome to even articulate it at all. Go ahead.
I mean, science in the academic world is supposed to have freedom of ideas and openness and inquiry and all that. Most scientists individually will say, yes, this is what's happening, but it clearly does not happen that way in the academic world. There are some topics you cannot study, and
right.
there are topics where there's huge amounts of prejudice.
Yes.
So if I can achieve anything, if I look back on a legacy of what I was able to do, if it was simply to promote more tolerance, then I would feel satisfied.
That's a wonderful. When I was teaching in university, one of the most interesting goal I had in teaching seminars was actually to teach the participants to act in a way that was tolerant of the ideas of people they might disagree with. And I think you're essentially describing something on a much vaster scale, and it's I think it's a wonderful thing. Thank you for articulating that for us today.
Well, we really appreciate the time you've spent with us. Is there any new projects coming up, or ways for people to see talks you might be giving, or interviews about the book and things like that?
Well, this will be the 48th interview I've given about the book.
Wow.
Since July when it came out. And I will have a number of not quite as intense interactions next year, but continue to talk about the book and promote it as best as I can. In terms of our research, most of it right now is still focused on mind-matter interaction, and we're wrapping in theoretical concepts more and more to both try to make it more palatable to physics today, but also to provide guidance, because we would love to come up with some kind of a theoretical explanation that makes sense, but also predicts a new kind of experiment that we haven't done yet. And of course, that's where a cycle of experiments and theory make very powerful in science. And so that's what we're moving towards.
Well, that sounds very exciting, and we look forward to hearing more about that as that work develops. So just once again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this work. We think you are doing really exciting, profound work, and as Rob said, you know, it's a great gift to the world because it's helping to lighten things, and that's
tolerance in any realm is a wonderful thing. Yeah. So thanks a lot.
Right. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and I'm sorry my internet connection has been a little bit erratic, but maybe I can come on in the future when we have a better signal.
Well, that would be awesome. Great, and we just want to wish you a continuing happy solstice and all the holiday cheer you can muster.
Thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been talking with Dean Radin. Dean is the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, and co-editor-in-chief of Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. His latest book is Supernormal, Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities, published this year by Deepak Chopra Books. I should mention that the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, is located in Petaluma, California, and they're doing great work out there, so we encourage you to support them in any way you can. And this part of the work they're doing was just evinced by Dean's discussion today, so there's a lot of other activities going on just like that. All right, well, next week on The Mystical Positivist, we will feature a conversation with Sister Greta Roningen. Originally from Kalamazoo, Michigan, Sister Greta spent much of her youth in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She is currently enrolled in the master's program at Claremont School of Theology with an emphasis in spiritual formation. Sister Greta serves as a chaplain in the Los Angeles County jails, and she is implementing a 3-year spiritual formation program that she developed for the young women at Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall called the Good Seed Project. She enjoys gardening, the evidence of which can be seen in the beautiful garden areas around the monastery. Sister Greta is Oblate Director for Community of Divine Love in San Gabriel, California. Tune in for that show on Saturday, December 28th, 2013. Upcoming on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, the Renewal of Presence Practice Group with the Tayu Meditation Center staff will be meeting Tuesday at 7:30 p.m.
No, it won't.
Oh.
It's
oh.
Christmas Eve.
Oh.
Oops.
Well, never mind that. That's right. It's Christmas Eve. We
yes.
won't be meeting till January. However, after Christmas, as part of the Thursdays at Many Rivers series, the View from Luminous Peak, a poetry reading. This is with poet Richard Dinner, a.k.a. Lama Jampa Dorje. That will be Thursday, December 26th at 7:30 p.m. at Many Rivers Books and Tea, 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. Lama Jampa Dorje, a.k.a. Richard Dinner, will read poems from a book from Luminous Peak and talk about his experiences during 4 years in a mountain retreat, completing the Dzingpa Rangdrol, self-liberation of clinging, cycle of practices in a Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhist lineage. Richard Dinner is a poet, printer, yogi monk who lived in the Sebastopol area for 10 years before moving to Taramandala Retreat Center in Colorado to do a traditional Tibetan solo retreat. He publishes Depress Chap Books, www.depress.net. Cows Community Radio thanks the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center for their support. OAEC is a nonprofit education center in Sonoma County that works to promote ecologically and culturally sustainable communities. OAEC is involved in local watershed restoration, a school garden development, and features Garden Volunteer Day every Wednesday from 10 to 5. Keep up with current events at www.oaec.org or call them at 707-874-1557. Chaos Community Radio would like to thank Occidental Video for their support. Along with the latest releases and archives of films appealing to all tastes, Occidental Video is the media center of Occidental. An internet cafe, Wi-Fi, copy, fax, and telephone services, along with the general technical advice, fills a vital need in our community. drinks, snacks, and a friendly atmosphere make Occidental Video a great hangout. Call Dan at area code 707-874-3840. Cows Community Radio is membership supported. That means that you can help keep programs like this on the air by going to cows.fm to donate your money, your time, your creativity. We have exciting projects this year, including moving our antenna from the hills behind Occidental to the ridge between Occidental and Sebastopol to increase our coverage in some of the population centers of West Sonoma County, including Sebastopol and Forestville. That will increase our listenership, make more resources available, but we need your help to get that done. So go to cows.fm and find out how you can donate. We appreciate financial support. We appreciate your hands. We appreciate your creativity in coming on and doing radio shows. So thank you again for joining us for the Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com. Join us again next Saturday. Coming up next from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is Ken Watts on Rockin' Record Hop, so stay tuned. Until then, we'll be listening to a continuation of an excerpt of a track called Composition, set to Rupak Tal from the CD Pure Joy, Positive Energy Music, featuring Hari Prasad Chaurasia on Bansuri flute, Anindo Chatterjee on tabla, and Viku Vinayakram on Ghatam. Enjoy.